Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. I had a lovely couple of weeks off, as you know. I had a trip to Fiji, which is only a three-hour flight from Australia, which is nice, very warm weather. All of that, nice beaches, and of course, the second I stepped away from the computer, a whole bunch of pretty wild stuff happened. We'll be getting to that in just a moment with Adam Boileau, our news co-host. This week's edition of Risky Business is brought to you by Senetas. They make layer 2 encryption tech. That's, I guess, their main thing. But they've also got a content disarm and reconstruction play now, Vitero, as well as their safe file sharing platform, SureDrop. But we're sticking with encryption in this week's sponsor interview. Senetas CTO Julian Fay will be along a little bit later on to talk about his trip to the International Crypto Module Conference. He'll be filling us in on what the agenda was there. Lots of talk about quantum-resistant crypto, and also some talk, there was a lot of talk there about streamlining various certification regimes, which may turn out to be wishful thinking, but we'll see. All that's coming up later, but first of all, it is time to look back on the last 3 weeks of security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, you and I were talking before we started recording here, and figured the best way to approach this podcast is to talk more in terms of themes than details. And the theme that has come through really is that cyber as the fifth domain, so to speak, in military parlance, I mean, that's, we're there. We are 100% there. And the events of the last few weeks have proved that.
Yeah, we've seen a bunch of stories come out over the last few weeks that, you know, kind of describe, you know, the rise of cyber in the public view as a real kind of, you know, part of geopolitics and a part of international relations and a part of you know, the kind of proto-warfare state that I guess that is in exists currently between the US and, you know, and Iran and China and Russia and all sorts of various other people it disagrees with. And yeah, it's, you know, you stepped away from the microphone and yeah, all sorts of bad things started to happen, or at least things that, you know, probably have been happening in plenty of other places, but we just haven't seen given as much prominence as we have over the last few weeks.
Mm. I mean, look, you know, I mean, the first cab off the rank, you know, when it comes to discussing all of this is the New York Times carried a report saying that the US is all up in Russia's grid, right? Which is not the sort of thing you expect to read. A few interesting details in the report too, such as the fact that Donald Trump apparently wasn't notified that this was happening, which seems seems to be a pretty bad idea, to be honest. I mean, this is the sort of thing you would hope would be kicked up for the highest levels of approval. But the idea that, you know, Cyber Command is going around and putting getting a foothold in Russia's, you know, energy networks, that's, you know, that seems like a bit of an escalation to me, although Russia has been doing it to them, so...
Well, yeah, that's, I guess that's the backstory, right, is that we've seen, you know, intrusions into various bits of critical infrastructure, power, telecoms, you know, all sorts of, you know, tech industry that supports national defense, you know, by all of the parties. And, you know, when the US Cybercom kind of got their, you know, leash taken off a little bit following, you know, the most recent US elections and given a bit more scope to do things that previously they would have had to ask permission for, you know, we have seen, you know, a number of reports, many from the New York Times, you know, talking about how they have escalated. And in this case, you know, getting into the Russian power grid, you know, part of this is, you know, you kind of expect them to do this. I mean, we've seen a number of commentators make the very valid point that, you know, cyber, using cyber in a weapon sense or in a military sense, you know, it's not like you can just drop a cyber bomb. It's not a very fast thing. You do have to go in and prepare the battle space, pre-compromise a bunch of networks, get all your tooling in place, understand enough about the environments that you're targeting that you're able to act on them when you really need to. So you would kind of expect this sort of thing to be going on. But what we are seeing here is, you know, a willingness to let that leak out.
Well, I think a lot of this, and I'd have to ask Bobby Chesney about this, but I think a lot of these types of activities require notification. And I'm wondering if that's why we're seeing a lot of, you know, clearly authorized leaks to the media in the case of some of the, you know, some of the Iran stuff as well. You know, you kind of have to notify people that you're doing this to that it was you. This is kind of a legal requirement. But again, I don't know if this counts as notification. It's something that I'd have to ask one of the, you know, the law experts on.
Yeah, I mean, Bobby Chesney's got a good write-up of, you know, some of the legal implications of the action that's been going on in Iran, you know, where the US have kind of, you know, let it be known that they've been up in the, you know, some of the military systems that support missile, you know, command
well,
and control.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that was the story that I was most interested in when I was on break. Clearly, you know, sitting on a beach in Fiji reading about this stuff, as I do when I'm on a holiday. But it was very interesting, right? Because, you know, the Iranians shot down apparently a drone that, you know, they say had strayed into their airspace. The Americans say was in, you know, international airspace, whatever, right? Not all that important. Key thing is a drone was shot down, and then Trump, I believe, authorized some sort of military kinetic strike and then changed his mind on that. And then it came out that Cybercom had actually disabled, according to some of the reporting, computer systems that controlled things like, you know, missile launches on the Iranian side. And I think that's an interesting, and I think they might have done some other stuff, in particular targeting the groups who had been collecting information about ships passing through various waters in that region and whatever. But I think the interesting thing is there, Grok made a snarky comment on Twitter saying, oh, well, I'm sure the vulnerabilities will be there next time they need them. As in, well, you know, now that they've shown their hand, the Iranians will be able to evict Cyber Command. But my take is a little different. Adam, can you imagine trying to evict Cyber Command?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's going to be, I imagine, rather challenging. And, I, you know, Grok has a point in the sense that you do, I mean, the equities process for deciding what capabilities you use when and where and what you let known you're being used does change the capabilities that you have, right? It's kind of that sort of Schrodinger's cat, like by observing the system, you change the state of it sort of thing. But yeah, on the other hand, you are also right that, you know, Cybercom, I'm not going to have one shell
yeah,
that they're going to burn, right? It's going to be a little more sophisticated than that, right? They do kind of know how to cyber a bit. But yeah, I mean, this whole thing is a real interesting mess of, you know, the technical aspects, the kind of the technical capabilities and the political willingness to use them. I mean, instead of, you know, when they're weighing up, you know, do we do a kinetic strike, you know, kill a bunch of people, or do we use, you know, cyber means to, you know, disable their missile defense system or disable the radars or, you know, ship tracking or whatever else. Because this was also, of course, following on the story about Iran allegedly putting mines on oil tankers in the in the Gulf.
But hang on, just one other point. I'm sorry to stop your flow there, but one other point I want to raise here is this does change the risk calculations on the Iranian side, right? Because all of a sudden, their rocket batteries went, okay? Now, that is probably going to change your calculations when you're thinking about getting into something a little hotter, right? If you can't depend on your military equipment, it's just been demonstrated to you that they can just effectively flip the switch on a whole bunch of stuff that you're going to need if you do get into a real, you know, quote-unquote real war. I mean, that's going to change some calculations for them, you would think.
Yeah, and I think that really is the kind of the key thing that's going on here, right? I mean, it's one thing to turn off those things for, you know, an hour or a few days or whatever. It's another to demonstrate that you have that capability and you're willing to use it and you're willing to let it be known that you've got that. Because, I mean, that's the thing that strikes me about this whole kind of episode over the last couple of weeks that's really funny is that, like, we are extremely unironically using the, you know, sort of the famous quote from Dr. Strangelove about the key thing about a doomsday machine being is that you have to let the other side know that you have it for it to be any use. And that's really what's kind of happening here is that there is a clear, we have this and we are also willing to use it. And that signaling is towards, you know, not just Iran, right? I mean, the stuff about the Russian power grid in both directions is really kind of, you know.
Well, signaling. Yeah, the Kremlin's not happy. We should point that out.
No, well, of course not, right? And I mean, for the Americans to, I mean, it's one thing for the Americans to you know, put themselves in a position where they could affect the, you know, the power grid or any other critical infrastructure in Russia or Iran. It's another thing to let it be known publicly, because at that point, the Russians do have to, you know, be seen to respond to that. That's where we are, right? We are at cyber as geopolitical deterrence, which...
Yes. Well, and it is, wow, you know, right? and it feels like there's a sort of regular tempo emerging. It's going to start feeling normal after a while, right? Like, I think this really is the moment. We saw the IDF strike against Hamas. I mean, but this is the reverse. I think Haroon Mir had a really good comment on this, which is we used to think of this in terms of if you cyber us, we'll bomb you. But it actually turns out that if you bomb us, we'll cyber you. That seems to be the actual dynamic, certainly in the Iran case, right? Like, it's all happening, It is all happening. And we've got the Triton Trisis attackers apparently getting all up in American stuff as well. So there is a lot going on. So for those who are interested in getting into some more detail on this, obviously head over to risky.biz and check out the show notes. Another big thing that happened, and, you know, this is something that we kind of predicted on the show, is, you know, this ban on Huawei being able to buy American technology and have American technology in its supply chain. That has been reversed as part of a trade truce with China, apparently, and that's ruffled a bunch of feathers. But I mean, you know, you could see this coming from a mile away.
Yeah, I mean, we saw, I mean, the sort of the second order consequences of this, all of the US companies that actually end up selling a bunch of stuff to Huawei as being kind of compelling. We saw a similar sorts of thing when ZTE kind of got the, you know, the trade death penalty from the US, and then they were reversed out again. But yeah, I mean, the thing that I guess is concerning a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum in the US and elsewhere in the world amongst the allies is, you know, how seriously are you meant to take this if you're willing to flip-flop on it? If you're meaning to take it from, you know, this is all about NATSEC and about protecting our infrastructure versus, you know, now it's just another trade issue. Like, what are we supposed to...
But that was, this action, you know, kicking them out of the US supply chain, you know, that wasn't a defensive action like banning the use of Huawei equipment. That was a punitive measure to punish Huawei for all other crappy stuff it's been doing, right? So I kind of think, I feel like this is much more defensible than, say, Trump saying, okay, as part of this trade deal, we're going to roll out 5G infrastructure using your kit. You know, it's not quite, I'm actually kind of sticking up for Trump here a little.
I mean, it does seem in some of the kind of finer details here that they are talking about, you know, still carving out exclusions for things that are, you know, more critical infrastructure. And you know, they are talking about, you know, kind of a subset of Huawei's industries or Huawei's products and stuff being, you know, kind of less restricted than we were originally talking about. So, I mean, there is a little bit of nuance here, but overall, it's just really frustrating, you know, when to a certain extent out here in the open community, we just have to take it on faith, you know, when we're being warned about national security related stuff, you know, by intelligence agencies through the governments, and all of a sudden it's not just about that anymore.
Well, I don't know. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, it's not just the US that has an intelligence community, right? And it's not just the US that has expressed concerns about Huawei. I mean, obviously the US has got a lot more clout when it comes to actually doing something about it, but, you know, it's not like we just have to take the Americans' word for it.
No, but we have seen them really kind of applying pressure on people, you know, not just the Five Eyes partners, but even other of their allies, you know, to kind of follow suit.
That's true,
You know, with the ban on Huawei and other Chinese vendors.
Yeah, and how much of that is NATSEC and global security, and how much of that is trade negotiations? That's a good question. That's a good point. Now, obviously, we're just speaking, you know, a moment ago about Russian activities, about Iranian activities. Turns out there's been a little bit of Russia on Iran action. And this one's, you know, it's like kind of funny, actually.
Yeah, it looks like one of the more experienced Russian crews managed to take over the part of the infrastructure used by the Iranian oil rig crew, and, you know, steal their network and use it for onwards access to some other target that the Russians were interested in. Or it's somebody else pretending to be the Russians, but that doesn't, the technical evidence does look somewhat compelling, that this is the Turlo crew taking over the oil rig crew and nicking their shells. Which
Iran's having kind of a hard time when you think about it, because they are getting shadow brokers, right? And like the scuttlebutt grapevine on that is like, no one really knows. I mean, you've got some people who think it's actually the Russians. You've got other people who think it's the Saudis. Could it be one of the Five Eyes partners? Like, no one has any idea, but they've got one crew getting shadow brokers. They're getting their rockets and missiles turned off by Cyber Command, and they're getting their botnets nicked by the Russians. Like, awesome.
And of course, you know, there's been a bunch of Iranian, you know, phishing campaigns and really kind of stepping up stuff in the mainland US. And yeah, of course, that comes with an increased focus from a bunch of the usual security firms. So yeah, Iran's having a pretty, pretty rough day of it.
Yeah, look, Iran is going wild too, upping attacks against American interests and America, you know, allies of America and their interests as well. I mean, we've seen some warnings come out of DHS, you know, out of CISA on that. So yeah, they are going absolutely wild at the moment. But also getting owned pretty hard by everyone else. So that's interesting. Now, Reuters published a fantastic investigation. This is by Jack Stubbs, Joseph Menn, and Christopher Bing, really looking at fleshing out some of the details around the CloudHopper APT-10 stuff. And I remember when that, was that last year or the year before? I can't remember now. But the original write-up about CloudHopper came, I think, from PricewaterhouseCoopers. And you and I were like both really into it at the time. But this report just has so much more detail in it, named victims. It's a great read and it made a huge splash.
Yeah, this is a really great story. And for me, it was probably the thing in the news list this week that I actually spent the most time reading, because it's kind of, you know, there's not much I can do about, you know, Iran and Russia personally. But this kind of thing, seeing details of this campaign, you know, by the Chinese to break into a bunch of different, you know, service providers, IT service providers, this is right in my wheelhouse. And so, yeah, I was really happy to see some good details in here. The story finally puts together some of the details about the, you know, various systems integrators and cloud service providers that were compromised in order to get to a bunch of their downstream customers. And we're seeing, you know, names like some of the names we've seen before, but, you know, Hewlett Packard Enterprise now, DXC, Fujitsu, IBM, a bunch of other organizations that provide those kind of services, and also some actual end targets that were being compromised.
Interesting detail in this is that the owned providers weren't exactly fessing up to their customers. I mean, that's scandalous. Well,
that, I think, is really one of the important things in this story, rather than necessarily the specific downstream customers that were being compromised. The story opens with Ericsson rolling incident response and then discovering that their ongoing compromise for, you know, 5 or 6 years was coming in through their outsourced service provider, HP Enterprise. And, you know, that's bad, right? But then the story does go on to talk to some people who are at HP and subsequently DXC, who were rolling incident response on the internal network trying to figure out what had happened, and who were being told not to communicate specifics about that intrusion to their downstream customers that had been compromised through them. And that really, I think, should make everybody who buys outsourced services from these big vendors really give them some pause about exactly how the, you know, incentives and motivations for your outsourced partners really line up, because they don't, in this case, clearly have the best interests of their customers at heart. And that's a thing you really kind of need to take into account.
But look, you know, it's interesting that you describe this one as being in your wheelhouse, and the, you know, the Iran and Russia stuff is not so much, because I finally feel like, you know, with the arrival of cyber as the active fifth domain right now, I sort of feel like for the first time, we really should be encouraging enterprise CISOs to be aware of some of the activities of some of these groups, because I can think of 10, 20 sectors that would be impacted if Iran decided to really raise hell somewhere like America, right?
I mean, I guess I mean by that, in terms of my wheelhouse, like, this is a thing that I personally have done, you know, as opposed to, you know, breaking into missile control systems in Iran. I haven't.
Are you sure you haven't done that?
Not done. But I mean, in this case, the CloudHopper campaign, you know, it is Russian. I mean, in this case, the CloudHopper campaign is the Chinese, right? I mean,
that's espionage. It's not destruction, right? And that's why I think it's a little bit different now, because we've seen the espionage stuff for a long time. You're losing intellectual property, strategic business info. Okay, that's a problem. But, you know, if Iran gets into the bank that you're responsible for securing and bricks all the routers, what do you do then?
Well, yeah, exactly. And we have seen the North Koreans do that in South Korea. And we've seen, you know, a bunch of places where, you know, those things have happened at, you know, at a state's behest. I mean, one of the things I guess we've seen over time is that, you know, people now understand what's possible with espionage in the cyber domain, you know, in terms of collecting records or breaking into stuff, of leveraging all of this access to get what you need for espionage. That understanding about what's also possible in terms of real warfare, of interfering with weapon systems and in critical infrastructure for availability rather than for confidentiality, like, that's a thing that people are now starting to really understand because of this normalization process. Because that's really what we're seeing, is that this stuff has become, you know, a normal part of international relations, and, you know, everyone's going to want a piece of that.
Yep. And an interesting story here in light of all of this reporting on APT10 is that Microsoft is going to actually require multi-factor authentication for cloud solution providers. So it's an interesting story, right? Because a lot of people, they'll buy their Microsoft, like, you know, cloud licenses from third parties because the licenses can actually be cheaper, not realizing that those third parties get, like, admin access to everything of theirs and often don't use two-factor auth. So Microsoft trying to shut that down.
Yeah, it's about time. Like, the fact that was even a thing they allowed all is just is ludicrous, right? And we've seen this is actually based on a Krebs story about a particular Microsoft partner that did exactly that. They had single-factor auth on a bunch of their accounts. They got compromised to get to the downstream customers. And that's just, you know, and especially for people who don't necessarily understand that that's what buying it from a third party means. Yeah, it's good to see this being raised, because, I mean, so many people are adopting Azure and all the Microsoft cloud products, and really understanding how those are going to get owned is super important.
Yeah. Now, look, there's some other interesting Chinese, recently discovered Chinese activity to report on this week. This story originated from some research at Cyber Reason. Their PR did a bloody great job on it because it's everywhere. We've got the CyberScoop version in this week's show notes. But Chinese state-backed attackers have been hitting telcos all over the place to collect information on, you know, various subscribers of those telco services. So really, you know, proper GCHQ style Belgicom stuff, if I can be cheeky.
Well, this is what signals intelligence agencies are for. And we moved it all off satellite links. You can't just snuff it up with an iron sands or something else, pointing at the sky. Maybe it's difficult to do it on undersea cables because of the TLS. We make handsets hard to break into. What are you going to do? You're just going to go to the telco and steal the call data records. And that's what the Chinese have been doing here. The story here is reporting they broke into something like 10 different cell operators around the world, specifically to target call data records and other metadata information, you know, location and whatever else, it seems like pretty classic SIGINT to me. They're going to SIG the INTs wherever they are, right?
Yeah, that's it. And it's not just the Chinese who've been sort of had their hand shown. We've got Russia's Google, Yandex, was apparently owned by Western interests using Regin, so a Five Eyes partner, targeting various users of, Yandex, which is, yeesh.
Well, I mean, what do you expect them to do? I mean, it's where all the information is, handles identity management for a bunch of Russian internet services. It's kind of where you'd expect the Five Eyes to be up in, didn't you?
Oh, a couple of stories here, one from The Guardian, one from The Intercept. One says, The Guardian says it learned its journalists were going to be targeted by Saudi Arabian hackers based, following the death of Khashoggi, the activist. And The Intercept has reported that the Project Raven types in the UAE were looking to target its journalists over its coverage of the Project Raven stuff. So, yeesh. It's a pretty dangerous time to be a journalist talking about this sort of stuff.
Yeah, that is a little bit close to home, isn't it? But yeah, the story from The Guardian is based on some leaked documents from the Saudi palace, where there was kind of a tasking order to go and break into The Guardian to find out a bunch about sources. And then, the story for The Intercept is pretty similar. The Project Raven team were instructed to go after them after some coverage about dark matter that The Intercept ran. They were instructed to go and look. And in both cases, I think The Guardian and The Intercept are saying they haven't seen any particular, IOCs to suggest that these campaigns were successful, but
don't know, do you? Funnily enough, I've started getting press releases from MBS, from Saudi Arabia, and I don't know how I wound up on that list, but I'm getting press releases from Saudi Arabia at the G20, and I'm like, okay, that's pretty interesting.
Maybe don't go to the embassy to pick up some paperwork.
They're just saying hi. Great story here. And this one is a collaborative effort between Motherboard, The Guardian, and the New York Times, and also the German public broadcaster NDR. They have discovered that tourists entering Xinjiang, where the local population, that's the Uyghur population, which are being, horribly treated by the Chinese government. If you enter that region, it's likely you're going to have like malware just installed on your mobile device. They're just grabbing every traveler's phone and putting this stuff on it.
Yeah, the story describes the process of kind of crossing the internal border into the region, and you have to go through a bunch of security screening and things, and apparently that process can take something like half a day.
It's an international border as well from Kyrgyzstan.
Right, yeah, in whatever border, I guess, you're going across into that region. You end up having to hand over your devices and they are installing, a piece of software that rummages through your phone, takes a copy of all of your messages, all of your contacts, everything else, usernames from other apps you've got installed, and, shovels them off into some server on the internet, presumably to be stored on unsecured, Elasticsearch in Amazon or something. And then used for whatever else they plan on doing, which, is a pretty horrible experience. But on the other hand, it's kind of the tone of the piece about, being shocked that this happens to foreigners going into the region compared to the kind of oppression that the people who actually live there get. It's almost, pales into insignificance compared to that.
But you do. I mean, it's just, to me, it's a sign of just how locked down that region is, right?
Yeah, it's certainly a pretty scary kind of trajectory that all of the surveillance, you know, all of the surveillance state apparatus, you know, around the world in various degrees of sophistication kind of ends, like, this is what peak surveillance looks like. And it's pretty terrifying.
It is. It really is. Now, switching gears for a moment, Black Hat had offered its keynote slot to a congressman by the name of Will Hurd, a Republican congressman from Texas. And then they revoked his offer to speak there because he has a voting record on women's issues that a lot of groups say is appalling, but looks like a pretty typical Republican voting record on this stuff, right? I mean, you're talking about a Texas Republican. It's really difficult for me to form an opinion on this one. I mean, you've got to keep in mind that I live in a country where our prime minister is quite right-wing, and he's quite religious. He's very religious, in fact. And the government's stated health policy here is looking to fund more publicly funded termination services, pregnancy termination services for women, right? So, like, the whole, you know, abortion debate in Australia is very much settled. So when you look at the US, you know, someone here who's sort of espousing the view that abortion should be restricted and stuff, like, someone doing that here is sort of on the fringe, whereas in the United States, it's just such a mainstream view among Republicans. So it's like, it's just one of those cases where the US just looks like such a bizarro world that I've got no frame of reference, Donnie. I've got no frame of reference.
Yeah, and I'm 100% with you there. Like, I read this and I just don't have enough local context to really wrap my head around it either. I mean, we have Jacinda Ardern as our prime minister, right? I mean, we're so far away from, you know, those opinions will be so far, you know, in the weird edge case here in New Zealand that, yeah, I just don't even understand how it's a thing that anyone's talking about still in the year 2019.
But the fact that it is still a thing.
But it is.
Right? In the US. And the fact that this guy is actually accountable to his voters in his district, you know, just makes me think, well, okay, you know, this is, if you exclude everyone who holds those views, that's like a fair chunk of the US population. But, you know, it's a weird one to think about, isn't it, when you're not from America?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a strange one to look at from the outside, and I don't know necessarily what the right thing to do. I mean, as a conference organizer, you know, I don't think I would put someone who had, in my mind, fringe views or something that made my audience, you know, and looking at the some of the, you know, the feelings from women who are most directly affected by this, it would seem to me that it would be obvious to listen to them. But once again, I'm not an American. I don't have that context. So,
yeah,
you know, I wouldn't do it in KiwiCon, but. You know.
No, but I mean, I'd have him on the show, right?
Yeah, that's true, right?
You know,
I mean, I think as you said on Twitter, like, if people knew the views of some of the people who appear on Risky Business, we'd all lose our collective.
Your minds would be blown. There's some pretty interesting people who I don't really agree with on much, shall we say. But, you know, maybe we will get him on to talk about that. I think, you know, people are being a little bit hysterical about this being a freedom of speech issue. It's not. It's not like this guy doesn't have other avenues available to communicate his message. He's been on Fox. He's on CNN all the time. Do you know what I mean?
He gets to vote.
Yeah, exactly, right? So I don't think this is a freedom of speech issue. And I think Black Hat is well within its rights to invite or disinvite whoever it wants, especially responding to, you know, community pressure. I just think the whole episode was a bit weird, and maybe not inviting elected representatives would be a good idea because America is so polarized. I think inviting a Democrat would be a terrible mistake as well.
Yeah, adding politics to a mix of already kind of complicated issues, like, maybe it's just easier not to. But then again, maybe that's a cop out.
But that's kind of what we do. So I don't know. Anyway, that was awkward. Moving on, and man, ransomware, city government networks are just getting hammered with this stuff. We've seen two in Florida knocked over in the space of a week. I think one paid $600,000. The other one paid like about $500,000. I mean, this is a thing now, right? Like, people have realized this is where the money is. You go for some of those lower tier governments that don't necessarily have the resources to spend on security. You ransomware the crap out of them and then you collect money.
Yeah, and I guess you only have to get a few to pay up. If you're getting, you know, $500,000 here and there, that does add up pretty quick. For what, in the end, it's not a whole bunch of work, I would imagine. But yeah, it is kind of unfortunate that we are seeing people actually paying out, because of course there's no guarantee that if you pay, you're going to actually get your, you know, get your files back or evict the attacker, and you're not going to get done again, you know, in 6 months' time. Although you would hope that they would also take this opportunity to clean up their act. But Yeah, it's just it's not great. At least one of the Florida cities apparently is paying for this with their insurance money, or at least they think they're paying for it with their insurance money.
Let's see.
We'll wait and see whether the insurer will put up with that.
Claim denied. Aw.
Yeah, I think they said they had, like a $10,000 excess, and they're going to get $600,000 out of the insurer. That's also not a thing that's going to carry on for particularly long, because the insurance companies are going to tell you to jam that real quick after the first couple.
Yeah, no, agreed. And the courts in the U.S. state of Georgia have been smashed with some ransomware as well, but they're kind of like managing to muddle their way through it. I did see some other reporting as well that there's some drive-by ransomware doing the rounds right now, tied to an exploit kit that's pretty good. It's, you know, no zero day or anything, but like there's plenty of unpatched browsers out there. So that is a thing that's kind of made a bit of a comeback. We haven't seen that in a while. So yeah, ransomware, ka-ching, ka-ching. We also saw when I was on break that this company that had suffered a breach, LabCorp, has filed for bankruptcy because of this breach, right? So this could be a company that has ceased to exist because of a cyber incident.
This is a company that was involved in the medical industry, and they had a breach of something like 20 million, they had a breach of something like 12 million patient records. They've subsequently claimed that the process of having to notify everybody about that, like the costs involved in that part of the breach, i.e. kind of putting some onus on the regulator for making them notify people because how rude, is one of the reasons that they're being forced into bankruptcy. Whether that's entirely true, I'm not sure. Krebs has a write-up that suggests that the company in question was also facing a bunch of other private lawsuits as a result of it. So it may be a case of kind of, you know, figuring out how they can get out of there as quickly as possible. But yeah, it kind of, you know, if you're looking for examples, if you're in the medical industry, in the medical world, if you're looking for examples of companies that have suffered, you know, existentially as a result of cyber issues to kind of shore up your budget, here's an example for your PowerPoint.
Coinbase got some special treatment recently with two Firefox O-Days. I think it was two Firefox O-Days targeting its staff, right? So that's kind of interesting that cryptocurrency exchanges are facing these types of threats, which look kind of, you know, it's about what you'd expect when you're facing down the Chinese government, right?
Yeah, but it, you know, goes to show, right? I mean, monetizing the cybers whatever way works is good, but cryptocurrency really does make you an attractive target. The story about the O-Days in this one is a little bit more interesting than usual, though, because these ones were bugs, like there's two bugs. One's a Firefox bug, and then one's a sandbox escape to get you out of Firefox into the OS. The first one was actually a Google Project Zero bug that got reported to Mozilla, and then after it was reported, got weaponized and leaked somehow. And the question is, like, did it get out of the Mozilla Bugzilla? Did someone in Mozilla leak it? Did someone break into Mozilla to find the bugs before they get patched? So, you know, it does, or was it discovered independently and none of that applies? But yeah, that bit's a little bit interesting because obviously we have seen attackers in the past, you know, breaking into bug tracking systems. And
well,
stuff
I mean, you know, if you got a bug, it's a great way to get more bugs. That's an operating practice as old as time.
And then, yeah, the local sandbox escape may have come from somewhere else. We don't know in particular. But yeah, it just goes to show, you know, zero day can and does happen and can come from a variety of places. And if you're sitting on a big stash of crypto coin, you probably need to factor that into your, your calculus.
The FTC has settled with D-Link. Now, you would remember we spoke about this like a couple of years ago. I think it was about 2.5 years ago. The FTC said, hey, you know, you've got advanced security written all over your nice shrink-wrapped boxes, but your products haven't been tested. They're really insecure. And, you know, you're in trouble, And it looks like what we've got at the end of this is no fine, but D-Link has given an undertaking that they're going to actually test their products and do threat modeling and stuff like that. So this is a good thing. This is a really good result.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those kind of, you know, lower to mid-tier consumer electronics vendors really don't try when it comes to security. And, you know, D-Link is definitely one of the worst offenders there.
And it's not like the FTC is asking for too much. It's like, hey, maybe you should, like, get a security consultant for a couple of days to look at stuff before you ship it. Like, you know, they're not setting the bar too high.
I mean, I was kind of disappointed there wasn't a big old fine just to kind of, you know, rub their nose in a little bit. But, yeah, making them, you know, actually do the things that they were already claiming that they were doing, I guess, is a good place to start. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen a bigger stick waved, I think.
There you go. Adam demands vengeance.
I've got someone stealing garbage at home and I want to, you know.
Cellbrite's all over the internet saying it can own anything at the moment, which is interesting.
Yeah, they've been pushing the latest version of their UFED product, which they're claiming will allow you to break into any mobile phone running iOS right up to the latest releases that you have physical access to, and they're selling it. You know, continuing, they've been selling this product, I guess, to law enforcement for a while, but yeah, the most recent release has, you know, modern, up-to-date iOS. The new version of UFED, of course, is their on-premise product. We have seen them offer, you know, the ability to break into modern iOS where you've had to kind of send the device to them, but, you know, shipping out a product that does it to the edge of the network, you know, to individual law enforcement agencies and whoever, does increase the chance that the tooling is going to end up leaking. I mean, you know, we've seen people buy other Cellbrite devices on eBay and things. So, you know, I guess Apple may be able to get their hands on it and, you know, old mate Snare or whoever can pull it apart and, you know, try and fix some bugs. But yeah, for now, they're certainly working the PR campaign.
Well, they might have some more generic bypasses they're going to reserve, right? Like, and that's what's enabling them to do this.
Yeah, you would imagine if you were them that you would have a stockpile and you'd, you know, you'd have some contingency plan for when one bug gets burned that you've got a few more in the pipe, or at least you, you know, you try and build enough pipeline to keep it going indefinitely, and you know, maybe you get there, maybe you don't.
Now, we got some detail on the Wipro attacks. Now, this, you know, Krebs first was the first one to report on this, but that big outsourcer Wipro got owned and no one was really quite sure. But RiskIQ have tied this together and it looks like it was part of a very large campaign trying to do gift card fraud.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of tie a bunch of the pieces together. And yeah, it looks like we've seen the same crew that was doing. I think we had talked about a previous gift card fraud story that hadn't been tied to Wipro. But anyway, now they have been tied together. And from there, you know, a bunch of other, you know, I think a couple of other outsource vendors like Wipro and also some, you know, kind of retailers and other places that are involved in the gift card ecosystem getting hit by the same, you know, the same people with the same MO, the same software tooling, you know, presumably to make a whole bunch of money. And it doesn't really seem like this crew is slowing down either.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Krebs, he's got a great story here. And it's what we'd call the classic Krebs, where he just goes through and pulls the threads and basically doxes people doing bad stuff. But he is looking into this, this, you know, certified pre-owned, if you will, Android devices, these devices that shipped with malware on them. And he's pulling apart this supply chain infiltration and really, you know, basically fingering the people behind it.
Yeah, this is a good follow-up because we talked about the story, you know, I think a month ago now when it first broke, and it wasn't super clear, you know, all of the moving parts of, you know, the vendors involved and the various, you know, what the actual malware in question was doing. So yeah, Krebs has definitely done some quality Krebsing here, pulling the thread on the particular Chinese company and related set of companies and people that, you know, were building the various bits of Android malware, and then we're also involved in the supply chain of, you know, that was used to insert this into those phones that were getting pre-owned before you got them shipped. So yeah, if you're one of the people involved, then probably you should go to read the Krebs article and make sure that, you know, all of your identities haven't been completely burned.
Now, this story you wanted to take out of the news, and I defended it. I defended it, Adam. Because look, really, if you just look at it on the surface, right, some fraudsters set up like, you know, blockchain.com. They basically set up a clone of blockchain.com. They picked, I'm presuming, a similar looking domain and then put some advertisements around the internet so that people would eventually find their way to this clone of blockchain.com instead of the real blockchain.com. And okay, that's a fairly boring thing, but they got away with $27 million. Right. And that's why I defend having this story in there, because every time I see a story like this, and it's been a while since I've said this on the show, I'm like, why on earth aren't you and I better directing our efforts towards stealing cryptocurrency? Because it looks like such an easy way to make money.
Yeah, it's probably like blockchain.com, you know, with an L instead of an I or something. Buy some AdWords, you know, steal some coins, job done. $27 million. Yeah, that does seem like a better use of our time than talking about NatSec on the internet. Although in this case, the crew in question appear to have been busted by the Welsh police, I think.
Boo.
The Southwest Regional Cybercrime Unit in the UK, yeah. Whichever bit of the country that is. They apparently have rolled up six people for this particular piece of fraud. And so, yeah, someone's going to go to jail for typosquatting blockchain.com, which, you know, maybe that's why we're not doing it.
I think my favorite one of all time was when someone took over an ICO, like there was an initial coin offering and all of their info was on a WordPress site that was vulnerable. So someone just took over the WordPress site and swapped the Bitcoin address and they got millions out of that. They didn't get caught. Anyway, interesting one here from Bleeping Computer. I found it interesting anyway. Just some Android malware that's basically hooking notification services to grab 2FA codes from the notification services. So it doesn't, okay, sure, you can use that to like grab SMS codes, but any app that actually puts 2FA codes into a screen notification like this will, this is a technique for grabbing those codes. I don't know if that's been a thing for a while, but it's the first time I've seen it, and it's, you know, it's a cool way to skin that cat.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, it was kind of cunning in the sense that the Trojan apps were things that, you know, had a legitimate notification feature, and so they would encourage the user to accept, you know, give them permissions to receive notifications, when in fact it was doing that to then steal multi-factor auth from other, you know, cryptocurrency wallets on your phone. So, I mean, I guess they made some money out of that, perhaps. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's an interesting technique.
Yep. And apparently there's some bugs in LTE, or flaws, as they describe it. So I don't know if that's a bug or a feature, but apparently it is reasonably easy to spoof the presidential alerts that go out to people's phones.
This was a piece of research that came out of the University of Colorado Boulder, looking into how the, you know, push notifications for alerts work on LTE networks. The short version is that those messages are sent via like a broadcast channel that's unauthenticated, because it's the mechanism that the phone handsets use to kind of discover and get metadata about the network from the cell towers. And so by running up a, you know, software-defined radio cell tower, you're able to send those messages over the broadcast channel, and they just appear on the phone unauthenticated. There's a little bit of fiddling involved, because the phones have to be not currently, like, they have to be in the idle state, like not actively associated with a cell tower. But the researchers present a mechanism to kind of force a disassociation, or to encourage a disassociation from the live network.
This just sounds like a bad design, right? Not a bug.
Well, I mean, it's partially a feature in the sense that the 3GPP standards body that came up with this kind of intended it to work without authentication for maximum compatibility. but yeah, I think that, you know, nuance will probably be lost next time someone does this, probably at DEF CON this year, and sends, amusing messages, shall we say, via
I was trying to think
mechanism.
Of one that was like safe for the show as well. And I was struggling. I'm like, think of a joke. No, too hard.
We all know what's going to happen.
We all know what's going to happen. NASA had a bad time, apparently, because someone put a Dropbox somewhere in their network, and the attacker was able to get a lot further than they had any right to go, really, or when you read this story.
Yeah, the story goes that a Raspberry Pi was plugged in somewhere on the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's network, and then that was used to, you know, own up a bunch of stuff, pivot onwards into the deep space network, and then the rest of NASA kind of panicked and unplugged the networks a little bit. It's not 100% clear from the reporting we've seen whether it was a Dropbox in the sense that someone maliciously, you know, got into the premises and dropped it, or whether some, you know, normal, like some insider had plugged in a Raspberry Pi that was either pre-compromised or subsequently got itself compromised because of whatever else thing it was doing, and that was a little bit unclear. But either way, you know, getting NASA owned is probably not a great day at the office for whoever's Raspberry Pi that was.
Now, I think the last podcast we did, we spoke about that Exium bug, which looked to be a pretty bad one. And indeed, people are exploiting it. We've seen the hypey headline saying 50% of the world's mail servers are under attack, which, you know, as you pointed out, is not really an accurate description of what's going on. But Microsoft has issued a warning on this one itself. They're blocking it in Azure, right? I'm guessing they're just dropping the packets. But it is interesting because they're saying to their customers in their notification, they're like, okay, we're dropping this worm, but you're still vulnerable, you know? So that's maybe something for people to act on if they're running Exium.
And it's also funny because, you know, we're at the state in the industry where Microsoft's, you know, running that much Linux on Azure that they're the ones responding to and preventing Linux worms. Like,
yeah, they're running more Linux than Windows on Azure. And I don't think it'll be too long before we actually see Microsoft Linux. I just have a feeling that that's going to happen. That will be a thing that happens.
Crazy topsy-turvy world. My beard is sad somehow.
It would be funny if that was the way we got Linux on the desktop.
let's be honest, it's the only way we're going to get it, because us Linux nerds aren't going to manage it otherwise. Jeez. Okay.
Would you run it? Would you run Microsoft Linux? I mean, I'm guessing it'd be pretty good, actually.
That's the thing. It probably would work. No, like, otherwise, right, the year of Linux on the desktop was about 2003. three or four.
Yeah, that was when I was working for ZDNet, right, in Sydney, and it was the year of Linux on the desktop.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, Debian userland on Windows kernel, like that sounds pretty good.
There you go. There you go. You heard it from the bearded guy. Bring on Microsoft Linux. And that's it, mate. We actually got through that in a manageable amount of time, which I cannot believe. Thank you very much for joining us. It's great to be back on deck and great to speak to you about all this stuff. I actually miss it when I'm away. It's always great to get your perspectives on this. And I'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. It was fun. And I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look back on all the security news we missed over the last couple of weeks. So big thanks to him for that. And I think you just heard us talk about something like 40 news articles there, but I had actually culled that down from an initial list of about 200. So yes, there is lots happening right now in the cybers. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Julian Fay of Senetas. Senetas makes layer 2 encryption gear, but it has diversified a bit of late. It acquired a controlling interest in Vertiro a while back, and Vertiro makes content disarm and reassembly stuff. We had the Vertiro founder on the show a while back in one of these sponsored segments, and I did wind up getting quite a few emails from people asking, you know, who was that company again? Because, it turns out quite a few people were interested in that one so that they, you know, it was a bit of tech they could give to their HR departments so they could safely open a zillion resumes a day, that sort of thing. Senetas also runs a file sharing service called SureDrop, which is like an enterprise-grade Dropbox, I guess you'd call it. We're sticking with encryption themes in this interview. And when I interviewed Julian, which was a few weeks back, this one's been in the can, he'd just returned from the International Crypto Module Conference. So I asked him to tell me what people were talking about there, you know, what's shaking in the encryption industry. That would be a good place to find that out. And here's what Julian Fay had to say.
Yeah, so it's the International Crypto Module Conference. It's an event that was started a few years ago, and it's really designed for people who are working in the certified crypto module space, principally centered around FIP certification. So it's a good conference because you get a wide range of attendees there. You get the government NIST representing the labs, the certification bodies. You get the labs that are actually doing the testing. You get a lot of vendors who are building sort of serious cryptographic solutions, hardware and software that are going through FIP certification. You get a lot of academics there who are working in the encryption space. And then you get just a lot of users who are using cryptography. So, you know, I guess people who are kind of in the serious end of the cryptography business who want to know what's happening, what's going on in the world, what's likely to be items of importance over the next few years go. So it's a well-attended, diverse event. You get a good global audience there as well.
Well, and I'd imagine it's just the place to go to if you want to, you know, get your finger on the pulse of what's happening in the crypto industry and the crypto field, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not a sort of pure mathsy, you know, deep down in the algorithm space. There's a little bit of that, but it's really about the industry, what's happening and where it's heading. So, I mean, there are a couple of things that sort of really jumped out in the past, which I think hopefully be interesting for listeners for updates. So there's about five or six different streams that they run over the week. And increasingly, one thing I've noticed is over the last couple of years, the post-quantum cryptography stream has become increasingly prominent. And NIST were there basically giving us a roadmap update on exactly what the standardization process is going to be for the next generation of public key cryptography.
Yeah, so it's not a blip. This is something that is, you know, progressing as you would hope it would.
It definitely is. In fact, even in the last 4 weeks, US DOD through DISA have actually put out a white paper requesting products to allow them to evaluate quantum encrypted information transfer solutions because, and to quote their paper, arrival of the quantum computing era is inevitable, although its timing is unknown. DOD must begin now to prepare its information security systems to protect against quantum computing attacks.
It's pretty quaint, isn't it, that they say it's definitely coming, we just don't know when.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows when? But that's happened in May, so that's fairly recent. You know, it's in the last 4 weeks. And I think it sort of shows the kind of seriousness with which, you know, organizations like US Defense are actually approaching this. And it's good to see that NIST, which is actually the standard setting body, is kind of keeping up with that. So quick snapshot that some takeaways that I learned. For those of you who've been following this process, NIST started about 18 months ago, a process for basically standardizing the next generation of public key cryptography. They went out to the community. They got 82 submissions from global submitters, of which they accepted 69 for the first round candidates. And what they've done is they basically spent the last 18 months looking at the security analysis of those first round submissions. And the way they do that is, obviously, NIST got a bunch of really clever mathematicians, but they really essentially rely on the global crypto community. So there's some very active email forums that anybody can actually sign up to. If you want, just go to the NIST PQC website. You can sign up and listen on that if you're interested. But they really do rely on academic community, journals, conferences, et cetera, to really help understand, you know, what the security outcomes and where each of these candidates are sitting. And then what they did in January this year was they drastically cut that shortlist, and we're now down to 26 second round candidates. And that's kind of interesting because they had to decide what criteria they were going to use to make that cut. Obviously, you know, several of the algorithms were flawed in some regard from a security perspective.
Yeah, no, there were a few absolute clangers there. I had one of the Trailer Bits guys on the show talking about that.
Yeah. So there's some obvious ones that had to be cut. In that first round, they didn't really focus on performance. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But one of the goals was really to ensure that there remains enough diversity in the approaches of the solutions. So
you don't want to pick a whole swag that with similar approaches, right? Because they might get knocked out later. That's the thing with these things, right? Like, you just don't know when enough people have had a go at them whether they're going to hold up.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for encryption, key establishment, and signature algorithms, basically. And they really need a range of ideas with different mathematical structures, because some of the mathematical assumptions behind these new approaches are actually quite new in many cases. So they've really kept a variety of the different mathematical approaches in there, which I think is a really healthy thing. And so what they're going to do now is they've got that shortlist, and the next evaluation phase is going to include much more of a focus on performance and usability. So they're going to be looking at performance in hardware and software. NIST is basically looking for optimizations for ARM Cortex M4 chips. That's a sort of typical microcontroller that's used in, you know, billions of devices. So they want to get pretty good optimizations on that whilst not reducing the security. And, you know, that leads to lots of trade-offs in the evaluations. You know, with signatures, you're trading off key size, signature generation versus verification time, etc. And then with encryption, you're sort of trading off key size versus ciphertext size. So there's some real usability issues that need to be sort of factored into this process.
But it sounds like everything is very much on its way.
Yeah. So what we heard was that the expected timeline is draft standards in 2022, possibly 2023, which when you think about it is, you know, is like 2.5 years away if it's early 2022, which is very, very soon. And those draft standards, you know, there's already some pretty good open source and commercial quantum safe implementations of some of those algorithms that we're already starting to see adopted into some commercial solutions today.
So some of this stuff is production ready, you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, there's
well, I mean, it's not that it's production ready, but it is in production, I guess.
What a lot of organizations are doing, and we're included in this, is we're basically moving towards a hybrid approach where at the moment, you can't pick a winner because there are no winners. We don't know what the standards bodies will set. But what you can do is you can kind of intelligently allow your customers to at least experiment with hybrid approaches to this, where you're double signing, you're double encrypting with an RSA or elliptic curve classical encryption algorithm.
Sense.
And then you wrap it with one of the NIST candidates, which has just got a lot shorter. So there are several open source libraries.
Well, because I'd imagine for a lot of the buyers of this stuff, the reason they'd be interested in this is because they want to future-proof anything that's intercepted now that might get unlocked later, right? So, you know, double wrapping at this point, okay, you know, it might not be perfect, but at least you've got a chance at being resistant to some, you know, future quantum tech.
Yeah, exactly. And we're seeing some approaches like using X509 certificate extensions to carry a quantum safe key. Yeah. So the idea there is that, you know, you've got a piece of software that doesn't understand any of these
algorithms. Hey, dog, I heard you like cryptography, so I put a key in your key so I could encrypt your encryption.
Yeah, can't use it today, but maybe at some point in the future, hey, what's that in my bowl? I'll turn it on and see what happens. So we're kind of getting some interesting approaches like that. where you basically, in my view, we need a set of tools and capabilities to help us migrate from where we are today to where we'll need to be. And there'll be this sort of interim messy stage in the middle, where we're all trying to kind of work out.
So was this the main talk of the event, this, quantum resistance stuff, or were there other key themes?
No, that's just one of the streams. Another area of focus was the fact that earlier this year, NIST announced that FIPS 140-3 has finally been, the timeline for that is finally clear. So this is pretty archaic, but if you follow this world, FIPS 140 is the standard for crypto module validations that is required for all US government use. And we've been on a standard called FIPS 140-2 since early 2001. And they've finally announced they're moving to FIPS 140-3, which probably doesn't sound very interesting. But a couple of interesting things just to call about that. That standard is actually for the first time based on an international ISO standard, which ISO standard 19790, which has a couple of implications. First of all, it was very controversial because it means you can't actually download that standard for free from the NIST website anymore, because it links to the ISO standard and you have to pay for that. So a few people are complaining about that. But more interestingly, some people are taking a view that it will lead the way to a harmonized crypto certification standard that is sorely lacking today.
Well, I was going to say, like, you and I have had that conversation before about the messy patchwork that is certification around the world. Like, you know, I'd love to sell this to the French, but they use this other one, right? Like, yeah, which is exactly. Basically the same, but like, it's theirs.
Yeah. I mean, we're currently going through three completely different global certifications at the moment for different geographies.
They're expensive too.
They're very expensive. They take a lot of time. They all have slightly different focuses. So you've got to do a lot of work and spend a lot of money. And some people think that the fact that, you know, NIST is now saying this is based on an ISO standard perhaps might lead to a sort of global harmonization. I'm not so sure. NIST has said that they will be publishing some annexes to that standard later in the year that will allow them to characterize it for their own requirements. But you're right,
bureaucrats are going to bureaucrat, right? Like, they're going to say, oh, well, that's all very well and good that these globalists in America have come up with a global standard, but, we're going to stick with what we know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it would be good to simplify it a bit. It's a real mess.
I'm not optimistic either, I got to say, Julian.
No, I don't think so. But look, we remain eternally hopeful. It's possibly a positive step. Practically, it doesn't mean a lot. We've got about a 5 or 7 year window, I think, where before all of the current FIPS 140-2 certifications will be sunsetted, they will all of those products will then have to be, or prior to that, will have to be recertified with this new standard.
Now, just I wanted to speak about something else just quickly. For a long time, SafeNet was one of your key distributors. I mean, they were your only distributor, weren't they?
Yeah, they were our global distributor outside Australia and New Zealand for many years.
Yeah, so you had SafeNet, and then SafeNet got bought by Gemalto. It's like, okay, so far right. So normal, yep. Right? Okay, so then Gemalto becomes your global distributor, and now Gemalto has been bought by Thales. So you've been through this a few times. So your stuff is now being distributed by Thales, is that right? Is that deal still in place?
Yep, that's exactly right. Yep. So we're still working with a lot of the same people. They just happen to have had about three different business cards over the last few years. So we now have Thales as our global distribution partner, which we're very excited about, frankly. I mean, they're obviously a huge company, you know, with a pretty great reputation in aerospace, defense as well, now in cyber. And I think this acquisition really does mean that they're probably the leader in hardware security modules and key management and things like that. So, yeah, I think we're very optimistic about working with them and having them as our partner moving forwards. I think there's lots of interesting things that are going to happen there.
Well, Julian Fay, it is always a pleasure to have you on the show, my friend, to talk about, all things crypto, and crypto means cryptography, just in case anyone was confused. great to have you on the show. Always a pleasure to chat to you, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Patrick. Great to speak to you.
That was Julian Fay of Senatas there. Big thanks to him for that. And you can check out Senatas at senatas.com. That's senetas.com. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back in a couple of days with a soapbox edition of the show. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.